So the question was asked, why is it that when we enter a class in Talmud, it doesn't seem too interesting, yet there's a lot of the oral tradition which involves stories and the genealogy of the different races and stories about miracles and things that are actually very fascinating and interesting, and that's not what you find your standard class in Talmud dealing with. Right? That was basically the question. So, I'm going to answer you, and you might not like my answer, but I'm still going to answer you. It works as follows. The oral tradition is very encompassing and far-reaching. The oral tradition includes fantastic stories, some to be taken literally, some not. It includes how do you decipher which should and shouldn't be taken literally. It includes a lot of laws and a lot of details. And the oral tradition goes down to the nitty-gritty of what does the Torah want from me. But the oral tradition does more than that. The oral tradition really is there to give me the weight of each ruling, the background to each ruling, the logic behind each ruling, so that when new questions will arise, I will have the tradition, the wherewithal, to deal with it. So you have a Talmudic discussion about a woman that gets impregnated from semen that's in a bath. Until we had in vitro fertilization, everyone looked at that piece of Talmud and said, you know, that's so rare, even the Talmud says it's rare. Why does the Talmud bother discussing it? Today, when we have to rule about how children that are made by in vitro fertilization, with regards to what they take after the father, mother, etc., that's a priceless piece of information. Wow. You have a whole discussion about what happens when a cow gives birth to a pig. The Talmud says, how often does that happen? Why is the Talmud discussing this? Today, that they're talking about now, taking a mother's womb and putting it into her daughter, some girls are born without a womb, and they've discovered now, they're experimenting with it, but they're in the process of developing, transferring a mother who is no longer fertile, transferring her womb to her daughter, and today that we have surrogate mothers, today that we can make a cow give birth to a pig, we can do that today scientifically, well then it has a lot of relevance. I want to know, can I eat pork or can't I eat pork? If it was born from a cow, is it kosher or isn't it kosher? So today, I suddenly have a piece of Talmud that for 2 millennia seemed so far-fetched. The Talmud discusses in many tractates what happens if you can enter an arena without setting foot into it. Meaning in the laws of defilement and in many other laws. If you could enter the Holy of Holies from above without entering, you have so many discussions in many tractates. And for generations, it seemed like, what are you talking about? Who can flow? Today, from that we derive many of the laws of what happens to a plane, of what happens with a helicopter. Can a plane fly over a graveyard if there are Kohanim in the plane? There are so many laws that are relevant. The Talmud discusses, if you could float, are you in transgression of Shabbos traveling? If you're really not traveling on earth. Today, that piece of Talmud is priceless. That's what teaches us, can you be on a plane or not on Shabbos? I'm saying so the Talmud really worked based on their tradition to break down every halacha down to the finest detail. Now, we don't always know where the application is going to come up. But the brilliance of the oral tradition is in its exacting refinement of every halacha to figure out where it came from and to give me the background and the weight and the logic and how did I get there. The rabbis could have condensed the whole Talmud into a little Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. You get a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, it tells you here's what you do, here's what you don't do, finished, here's the code of laws, goodbye. They didn't do that. They purposely gave me the makeup, the understanding, the logic, the weights, so that I understand where were they certain, where were they uncertain, where did they have a clear tradition, where didn't they have a clear tradition. They were brutally honest. You have lines in Talmud that you'd think they'd censor out. You have lines where rabbis bash one another openly. You have lines where a rabbi says about someone else, don't catch me near him. Yeah. There was a rabbi who wouldn't talk to you in the street, wouldn't be seen talking to you in the street unless you were trustworthy enough that you could give that person a loan and you didn't even have to sign a contract with him. Otherwise, he wouldn't talk to you in the street. He wouldn't be seen publicly with someone unless he was of that high stature. And then the Talmud starts saying, okay, who would he be seen publicly with and who not? You know, that was a gauge because everyone knew. He was so brutally honest that he wouldn't talk to someone in the street unless he had a tremendously high level of honesty. Otherwise, he'd be like, good morning, and keep walking. You want to talk to me? Come to my office. I'm not going to talk to you in the street. I'm not going to be seen publicly as though I have a relationship with you, because people know that whoever I have a relationship with can be trusted. He didn't have to say it. Everyone knew it. And the Talmud gives us, you can go through the Talmud, and you will see lines that you couldn't believe they didn't censor out of it. But that's because they were very honest. And they wanted us to know what they did know, what they didn't know, and where they got it from. And that's why the Talmud keeps the whole to and fro. A layman looking at the Talmud says, why didn't they do an editing job? But what can you do? They spent 3 centuries editing the Talmud. 3 centuries. So what you're getting here is a perfectly refined book, and it's on purpose that they left in everything that they left in. All the questions and answers and back and forth. So the Talmud discusses, when you shoot an arrow, the two forces that are at play with an arrow. Today, science discusses two forces at play, right? The force that pushes up, the vector forces, no. What?
Three, gravity.
That's when it starts coming down. As it's on its way up, it's contending with gravity. There are two forces. And then on the way down, so the Talmud discusses that too. The Talmud discusses wind. And the wind factor, where are you responsible for a wind affecting? You lit a barbecue in your yard, and the wind came and took it to someone else's yard. How do we view that? So that gives me an understanding of natural disaster, natural effects. What am I supposed to expect, what not to expect? The Talmud goes into fantastic details from which we can apply our tradition to many. I can't say all, because we're not smart enough for that. But most of the modern questions that arise. The Talmud discusses at what heat the blood comes out when you slaughter an animal. And from that Talmudic discussion, we have definements of heat pertaining to halachos of all of Jewish life. The Talmud discusses which animals can be crossbred. And from that, we have a halachic definition of how you know which species are kosher animals or not. In South America, they found the zebo. It's a cow that looks like a camel. Is it a kosher animal or not? Well, the Talmud gives us definition based on the mating capacities of animals, how you're going to figure out. The Talmud discusses the teeth of the animals. The Talmud discusses, the Talmud goes into scientific detail that in their day was really wondersome. Like, why are you telling me this? You know what animals you have in town. What were the rabbis discussing? The rabbi said, well, maybe you're going to discover new animals. And here's the formula. The Talmud discusses, how do you know if a new species of bird appears, whether it's kosher or non-kosher? Why did they have to discuss that? They knew we'd have turkey today? So 600 years ago, when Columbus brought turkey from the United States, so we had the tools to deal with a new bird and decide that it was kosher. But you understand, for a millennium and a half, no one knew, why do I need this piece of Talmud? There weren't any new birds flying around. But the rabbis gave you a very, very clear tradition of the oral law. And with that, the rabbis realized that to the layman who approaches Talmud, it's not going to be so interesting. And so the rabbis arranged stories in the Talmud that have multiple levels of interpretation. And the stories were used to spice up the speeches, to keep the crowds interested. And the stories had deeper levels of interpretation, which the more you'll understand the tradition, the more you'll understand how they were answering basic philosophical questions. The stories are really there on dual levels. On the surface, they're telling you a nice story with a nice theme. Jewish tradition from the days of King Solomon is that every allegory must have a good message at the simplest level of understanding. Don't tell me a silly story. Any story you're telling me must have at the base level, without the deeper interpretation, must have an important message. If not, don't tell it to me. So the layman who heard the stories, so he took it all in and he understood it to be simply understood. Whatever the rabbi said, that's what happened. And from that he got a message. The more learned a person was, the more he understood the system they were talking in, and the more he understood, they didn't mean that literally, but they did mean an underlying message, which you needed a tradition to understand. When people speak about Zohar, Kabbalah, well, you know what? Every Medrash is Kabbalah. The stories in the Talmud are also Kabbalah. The Zohar is full because it's a Medrash that's filled with fantastic stories, so everything there is really depth. And the Zohar really takes the ideas that are in depth and brings them closer to the surface. The Zohar more openly discusses God's functioning in the world than other Midrashim. So that's known as Kabbalah. But in truth, the Medrash Rabbah is also Kabbalah. And so are the stories in the Talmud. So it's true that when you open up a Medrash and you start reading it, it seems fantastic. That's what it's there for, to entice you, to keep you interested. And it's natural that you hear stories, they sound nice. Some are meant literally, some are not meant literally. But it's true that that's far more pleasant learning, and it's fine. It's good that a person should take some time and read the Medrash says and learn Medrash. You have to appreciate that the higher level of learning, just like he described when it came to learning law, if you really want to understand the law, it takes a lot of work, because what the oral tradition is doing is breaking down each law down to the nitty-gritty. And from that nitty-gritty, we have applications today. From the fact that the Talmud discusses the question of how we treat fire, we understand today how to treat electricity, because the Talmud breaks down the energy in fire and the matter in fire, what's being lit and what's not. You have Talmudic discussions of where the matter and energy meet, and which one, where it's considered matter, where it's considered energy, and how you apply it halachically. You have a halachic discussion of how a magnifying glass works. You open the Talmud, so for generations they read that and like, who cares how magnifying glass works? Today it has huge halachic implications. We have all our heating systems is based on heating from the sun. Can you use that on Yom Tov or not? Well, you open up a Mishnah and Beitza and you see the rabbis already discussed that. You have a discussion in the Talmud about automatic traps. So from that we understand how a lot of our automatic systems can work. Can you have a Shabbos clock? Can't you have a Shabbos clock? You have a discussion of a windmill, you have a discussion of a water mill. You have a discussion of how far my actions can impact. If I open up the dam and water comes in and starts turning the gears, at what point do I say it's a continuation of my force and at what point not? And from there, we have halachic applications to, can I push a button and make matzah? Because I gave the initial force, which kept the current running, which will keep the matzahs making. So as you read, when you read the Talmud, at first glance, it's hard to understand, wait a second, where does any of this apply to me? But once you start understanding deeper and start reaching conclusions, you start realizing they gave me the formula to apply the Torah in every generation. The smarter I'll be, the more I'll know how to apply it. But you're right that it's like learning law. There are so many details. And when you sit there and you start reading the details, at first glance, it's boring. What do I care? So two people are holding on to talis. But you know what? There's a whole Gemara about what happens if a woman's husband falls off the boat and you look and you don't see him and you think he drowned. Can you tell her to remarry? What level of proof do I need in order to permit her to remarry? And because the Gemara went to such detail, today we have halachic guidelines when and where is DNA evidence accepted. So today I have to deal with DNA, but I can deal with DNA or blood type. There was a story here in Israel. A person was getting divorced, and he said he doesn't want to fund his wife's kid because it's not his kid. So the wife said, yes, it is his kid, and he has to fund it. And the man said, fine, let's do a blood test. He thought he knew she was committing adultery with someone. They did a blood test, and the blood type didn't match. It wasn't his kid. So the halacha already discusses what level of proof do I need, and the halachic court could rule on that because I have a ruling. They found swordfish. Is swordfish kosher or not kosher? It doesn't have the scales that regular fish does, because the swordfish scales are attached on both sides. Ordinary scales are attached on one side. They flap up and down. Swordfish has scales, but they're attached on both sides. Is that called scales or not? So the Talmud didn't have swordfish. But the Talmud went to the details of explaining to me, how do I know if it's a swordfish, if those scales are halakhically scales or not? And that's why today we know swordfish is kosher.
Is?
Don't tell anyone.
What?
Is? Isn't it only like baby swordfish? Well, there's different fish. There's like baby swordfish.
You have a discussion about, you have certain mammals that live both in water and on dry land. Do they have the criterion of an animal or a fish? Do they need fins and scales? You know, you have birds that also, they fly and they're also, they go in the water. Do they have, so the Talmud goes into the scientific definition. When's it a bird? When's it a fish? When's it an animal? All these things for generations did not have practical applications. For a millennium and a half, no one understood. What do I care? You care because it's the tradition, and you're going to have an exact definition of how the tradition works. Now, whether your generation will have an application of it or not, that's a good question. I can give you, we can talk all night about examples of that. The Talmud discusses in Alexandria in Egypt. They had a huge Colosseum. The Chazan would stand in the front. The people in the back couldn't hear the Chazan. But they could see, they'd wave flags to tell them when he reached the end of a blessing, and they'd all answer, Amen. From that piece of Talmud, I know that if I have live viewers who see me on the second and I make a blessing on a cup of water, they could answer Amen. If I say Kaddish, they could answer, right? Maybe Kaddish is a different question, but if I say Shmon Esrei, if we have a davening here, sometimes on Israeli TV, they publicize Purim davening, the nighttime davening of Purim, with the Megillah reading. So all the viewers all over Israel, can they say Amen to the blessing? Well, it's already been discussed in the Talmud. The Talmud discusses a similar scenario. So for generations, you'd ask, we don't have any shuls like that, right? Up until the last half a century, no one had a shul that was that big. Ever since Alexandria in Egypt. Who cares? Why'd the Talmud give me that piece of information? It delineated the halachic tradition. Now today we have tremendous application for it. Today you have blessings made on the radio all the time, and people hear it live and on TV, and you want to know, if you hear it live, can you answer Amen to the blessing or not? Well, you have the answer, because in Alexandria in Egypt, you had a similar scenario. People were sitting, they had 50,000 people in shul, they had these huge coliseums, and people were standing way back, no way they could hear the chazan. They'd wave a flag, everyone answered Amen. Okay? So you have your answer. It's enough that you know the moment when he finishes his blessing, and you can answer Amen if you know which blessing and when he's finishing. So I'm saying that you're right, that when you first approach Talmud, it seems like so many details. Who cares? This isn't interesting. That's true. With time, you start, the more you understand, the more you see how to apply it. And it's true that sometimes a person never reaches that level. Sometimes you end up learning two Mishnayot, you end up learning two pages of Gemara. So what you end up getting is a little bit of a taste of what the oral tradition is. So you know what's going on. But in the long run, even though things may not seem at first glance like, where am I going to apply them? In the long run, this is the greatness of the oral tradition. But you're right. For generations, even in the days of the Talmud, the layman did not have the patience to hear that. And that's why you have all these stories that the rabbis would stick in as they gave their speeches, teaching the laws with stories. More laws, more stories.
So, thank you for your answer. Is that I learned a lot from the answer. I enjoyed it also. Like, you know, it's pretty, actually very interesting, very fascinating. But it still strengthens my question in that, why, you know, someone comes to Bachol Meir for 1 year, why are they gonna teach him, you know, two people holding onto a talit and not, you know, coliseums in Egypt? And not, you know, person falls off a boat, DNA test, not in vitro fertilization, not the genealogy of, you know, of the sons of Noah and where we come from, and where we come from. Why not all that kind of stuff? Why does it have to be the, exactly. How come it can't be the fun stuff?
It's very hard to jump to the end at the beginning. Meaning, what the Machon is giving you is building blocks. We used to have many more staff members who began in Machon Meir not knowing anything. And when they came in, so they built the foundation, and off of the foundation they were able to build higher. We do try to also give you the practical applications, but in Talmud, what the Mahon is giving you is the tools to continue developing. At the end of the day, if you absorb those tools, you yourself will be able to keep growing. If you spend the time doing what's fun and hype and very interesting, let me learn all these practical applications, so you'll have a lot of fun facts, but you won't have the tools to continue growing. What the Mahon is doing is more difficult, but at the end of the day, you'll have the tools. If afterwards you'll want to grow, keep going to classes, develop your knowledge, you'll have the basis. What I'm telling you is high-level rabbinics. It's not, you know, it's not what's taught at a basic level. At a basic level, what the Mahon's trying to do is give you the tools so that you will be able to continue growing. You can't do that right now. You first have to learn how to read a page of Gemara. And just realize that growth is exponential. You multiply yourself every few months in Talmudic learning. Meaning it's not that 1 plus 1. It's, let's say you hit a 5, then it's 5 times 5. If the first semester you were able to finish 2 pages, the next semester will be 4, but the next semester will be 16. It won't be 8. And the next semester will be 100 and something. It's not, you're going to multiply yourself. That's how it works. So in the beginning, it's very hard. And you're working on every word. But as you gain these tools, you'll be able to cover ground better. And as you cover ground, it'll become more and more interesting. You're right that in Talmud, the more you learn, the more interesting it becomes. And in the beginning, it's tedious and not fun. That's true. But if you don't go through that, then you'll never get there. And to skip to the end, so that's like taking, okay, so you could take a lot of magazines, they'll give you interesting halachic journals and halachic articles, and they're very interesting, but you'll never know anything. You'll know what someone else wrote. You'll know interesting things. But if your goal is to develop your basis, that's what the Mahon is doing, and the Mahon is very successful at it. We have many students who worked with the system and came out, and they were able to finish Shas. It's up to the student, and grow from there. You go all over the country, you will find people who came here not knowing how to read Hebrew and reached a point where they built beautiful families and they learned a very nice level. But you're right that the beginning is tedious. It's not fun. Right? In the beginning, you have to learn, it's like learning alphabets. Yeah, it's hard. It's a prerequisite. I don't know of any other way. I think you should mention to your teacher that you would appreciate if he could take once or twice a week to show you the practical applications of what you're learning. And that's something which maybe he could interject. It cannot be the focus of the class, but he can interject it. Talk to him. Any other questions on this point or something else?
Well, sort of. You mentioned about, you know, whether it's the written Torah law, you know, why it's written, why it's not written. So I've heard recently that in Jordan, actually scholars have translated the Talmud into Arabic. And I've also heard, like, I guess in Korea, they're studying Talmud too. So I was wondering what you thought about, like, this, now it's translated into Arabic. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So Rabbi Feinstein was not a proponent of translating the Talmud into any language. Even though he didn't actively go and fight it, but he was relatively quiet because he was a man of peace, but he didn't think that was the way to go. Because in order to learn, and what I'm telling you now, I have on tradition from Rav Pesen Zatzal, in order to learn Talmud, it's not enough to translate the words, as we discussed earlier.
I'm talking about translating into English for myself or the other people in English.
I am, though, but I'm encompassing both. You understand? It's the same discussion, because it might be beneficial to people that they have an English Talmud, but by the same token that the Arabs now have a Talmud, so does the church. I'm saying, from the English, you also have a situation where I know a seller who told me that the church buys from him. Every time another copy of the English Talmud comes out, they're buying a few copies.
That was more my concern.
Right. So you have a situation where it's not only the Arabic world that's gaining access to the Talmud, it's the Christian world and the world at large. And at this point, it's out of our control. So it's far from ideal. It's not what the rabbis wanted. At the same time, I don't know about the Arabic and Korean, but into English, for sure it is.
Okay.
And it's not the first translation either. It's the second or third. So, at any rate, this is not what we would have wanted, ideally. But at the end of the day, by just having a translation, you're not going to master the oral tradition. It doesn't work that way. So that's also a problem, because it means they're going to walk away with a lot of misconceptions. They're going to read the Talmudic story about how they were traveling on a ship and they got off on an island and they made themselves a bonfire and they sat down to eat a meal, and suddenly the island started moving and they realized they were on this huge fish, and the fish started moving and they grabbed on and everyone drowned except for Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. And they're going to read it and say, boy, the rabbis had an imagination. But they don't understand that that piece of Talmud is not to be taken literally, as are two pages of Talmud there. That we have a whole tradition on why those two pages are there, and it has nothing to do with the literal interpretation. And there are other pieces of Talmud that are even more problematic that they're going to read, and they're going to say, what were they thinking? And the parts that they think they understand, they won't understand either, because you can't understand Talmud without a teacher. We had a student who came here. He was from somewhere in the Midwest. Didn't have any teacher, but he finished Shas. Okay? He's a diligent fellow. And you can really say about him, he was a person who did not know all of Shas. Okay? So all of Shas, he didn't know. Any tract that we tried talking to him about, he thought he knew, because he could quote you things from it, from the English translation he studied. But he never had a teacher. So he had things all backwards. He didn't know how to make heads or tails of the sentences he was reading in English. He didn't understand the concepts. He worked very hard, but he worked to futility. So for a year, he spent his first year here arguing with us, you know, showing us this, that, the other thing. Okay, we gave him a space. The second year, he realized, maybe I don't know. And then he started studying. And the third year, he gave up because he realized he had spent all those years studying, memorizing all of Shas, but he didn't know it. And it was frustrating for us too. We felt bad for him. He didn't know the basic concepts he needed to know how to work with the English translation. And in the end, he left. He left all frustrated, realizing he really doesn't know. So you have a situation where they might think they're going to know a lot of things. They're not. There's very little that you can really understand correctly without a tradition. It's very interesting, but that doesn't mean you're getting it right. I could tell you almost every word in Talmud requires tradition to understand. You cannot understand it literally. I'll give you a simple word. Aleph Yud Nun could mean ain, there isn't. Could mean in, there is. There are no nekudos, there are no vowels in the Talmud. How are you going to understand that? So the translator has to decide. You have the word Aleph Yud Nun Yud, which can mean one of two words, eini or eini, which have two different halachic meanings. You have the word, the abbreviation, aleph, tof, lamed, which can mean im timtza lomar or im timtzi lomar, two totally different halachic concepts. Every word you're going to go in Talmud, you have to know what it means, and in a translation you're not going to understand that. Take the word kapara. What is the word kapara? Yom Kippur. What does the word Kippur mean? What does the word teshuvah mean? Each of these words has pages written on them. Pages. Not a line, not a paragraph. Pages to define that word. Now, in a translation you're not going to understand that depth. And then you can't really make heads or tails of what the Talmud's talking about, because the Talmud on the surface is like you're saying, just discussing two people holding a talit. As you grow, you will understand that the Talmud is working on a much higher level of refinement. Meaning, at this stage, you're learning a very coarse picture of the Talmud. You're learning a general picture. This is a question, this is an answer. You're not yet learning that different terminology that introduces a question has different halachic weights. And different terminology that introduces an answer also has different halachic weights. There's a whole science to learning Talmud. It's not just questions and answers. Each question has its weight, each answer has its weight. The way a rabbi is quoted, whether it says the word Amar, he said, before his name or after his name, has two different connotations. If it says so-and-so said, it has one connotation. If it says said so-and-so, it has a totally different halachic connotation. You're not going to get that in a translation. I'm saying that there are so many details. When you have a quote from a brisa, if it says it was quoted in the academy of so-and-so, it has one halachic weight. If it says in the academy of so-and-so it was quoted, it has a totally different halachic weight. One indicates we rule like this opinion. One indicates you do not rule like this opinion. Go stick that into translation. Go figure that out. You're not going to figure that out. And there's no way you can get to the level of accuracy you need in order to really understand what the Talmud is talking about. You can't get that in a translation. And you can't get that without learning from a tradition. It's not going to work. But this was part of the idea of the oral law. That it would go by tradition. My tradition includes facial features. There are halachic questions that I have a tradition of how rabbis responded facially 250 years ago.
What do you mean? I don't understand.
Okay, I'll tell you a story. There was a big rabbi 200 years ago who was invited to a Shabbos table. And at the Shabbos table, the women started singing with the men at the Zmiros. And one of the students told the women, shh, the rabbi's here. And the rabbi gave him a look. And I have a tradition what look he gave him 250 years ago. And what that look meant halachically. You're not going to get that from a book. When you learn more, we'll discuss it. It involves a 45-minute introduction. You're not going to understand me if I just tell you. I'm serious, I'm not joking. I'm saying, if you want to understand what look he gave him and what that look meant, I need to give you 45 minutes of introduction on halachic ruling. I'm sorry, I'm serious, I'm not joking with you, I'm very serious. If you want, I'll give you those 45 minutes. But I'm serious. When I got it on tradition, I got it with a 45-minute introduction. You want me to give it to you? I'll give it to you.
Sure.
I don't think the rest of the guys want it. So I'm just saying, the tradition involves so many details that you're not going to get that. And you see it in Talmud too. Because the Talmud discusses which students got to see Rebbe's face and which didn't. Because part of the tradition Rebbe transmitted was in his facial features, not only in the words he said. And you see it in the Talmud when the Talmud discusses Shosik Rav. Rav was silent. So the Talmud asks, what does that mean he was silent? They asked him a question, he was silent. So the Talmud says, well, you could understand it one of two ways. Either he was silent because he was acquiescing, or he was silent because he was saying, you dunce, I'm not even answering you. Which one was it? The Talmud asks. So then the Talmud looks for who was there and who saw his facial features, who could interpret that tradition, which we have. Our tradition is he was silent. What does that mean? That means they had a tradition that the question was asked, and when Rav was asked the question, he was silent. And that silence has an added level of tradition, which the Talmud then goes searching for. You're not going to get that in an art scroll. It's not that, that's not that, you know, oral tradition is oral tradition, and you're just not going to get it from a book.
You don't get it from the Aramaic either.
If you know how to read the Aramaic, you'll get it. Maimonides says, in his generation, there were so few people who had the tradition that that's why he wrote his book in Hebrew, and that's why he wrote his book, because he says people just don't have the tradition, and they open up the Talmud, and they think they can just read it, and they're not getting it.
But the problem is, words are words, right? The words can be translated, including all the meanings that they include.
No, because we just said that the words can have dual interpretation, at least, if not more. There are words in Talmud that have four or five interpretations, and you have to really sit there and look at the piece and understand which one it is, and sometimes that exactly is the question that the Rishonim are arguing about. How do you interpret that word? The Gemara will sometimes answer a question and say, Vidilma, da-da-da-da-da. The Gemara asks a question, the Gemara gives an answer, but maybe you could say like this. Now, if you understand that word vidilma is a root of halachic discussion. Does the Gemara stand by that answer, or is the Gemara just having a theoretical argument? You haven't proven me wrong because maybe I could answer that. That's going to be the breaking point for two halachic rulings.
You can write that into the translation.
Right. But there are so many words you're going to translate as maybe. And the word vidilma has that question, and other words don't. Each word has their halachic way. The words are very, very exact in Talmud. And in the tradition in general. And then there are words which can be interpreted in many, many ways, like maitaima, which could mean, what is the reasoning? What is the source? And then another two more intricate interpretations for maitaima. There's a big difference between what is the reason and what is the source. Maibeinayu, people translate it as, what's the difference between them? That's not true. Maibeinayu means, what source did they differ on that caused this difference between them? Totally different question. And I could give you, I mean, we could spend the whole night discussing this. It's not, there's no way that a translation is going to encompass the depth and capacity for interpretation of the text, especially when that's built in. And it's not just a question of understanding Robert Frost.
Understanding.
Yeah, was Robert Frost? The Woods and I, yeah.
Yeah.
The path not taken. That has made all the difference. Yes. The Woods and I. Yes. You're not going to get that. It's not about poetry. It's about the words really encompass that, and you're not going to be able to do that in a translation. Okay.